All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. We are on issue 3, dead center in the beard of Alan Moore.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. I am Andrew Farmer. With me, as always, is the Jedi Cole Houston.
Ironically, I have my sub Alan Moore beard was shorn away even further recently.
Well, there's a shame level that when you're talking about Alan Moore.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't touch that kind of beard.
Yeah.
And like you might get cut or something.
You might get cut. or a spell cast on you of some sort.
Yeah, that's true. Or a cutting spell, perhaps.
A spell of cutting. And with us, spell of cutting with us, and I could not be happier right now for this. We have a very unique voice. He's only been on the show once before, but true comic historian, a comic reviewer and blogger, amazing cosplayer. Matter of fact, he is the only known Alan Moore cosplayer on the face of the earth, as far as I know, at least in the Western Hemisphere. I don't know what those crazy Australians do, but we'll have to ask one. But with us tonight is Matt Morrison. Matt Starman Morrison is here. Matt, are you out there?
Salutations, pitiful mortal.
Oh, God. Not only does he cosplay as Alan Moore, he voice plays as Alan Moore as well.
Wow, indeed.
Little Lulu, you're the one that I adore.
What was the show that you joined us on last time, Matt?
I was doing the graphic novels without pictures.
Oh, yes, yes.
Oh, episode 56.
Right. It was, man.
What no pictures? Was
man.
That?
56. You knew that.
To be fair, I just looked that up recently because I have a fangirl who was asking, as I was talking with her about being on the show tonight, she said, oh, what time is it? I want to listen. I said, well, it doesn't actually broadcast live, but here, let me find the one I was on for you. Sorry to break the illusion and make it look like I am not, you know, my knowledge of many comic things is encyclopedic. My knowledge of which episodes correspond to your show, not quite.
It isn't to us either, and we do it every week, so don't feel bad about that.
And quick little shout out. Hi, Alana.
There you go. Hi, Alana.
And I actually had to look up what number we're on right now.
Well, yeah, it's 135. It should be 135.
Yes. This is I Am Legend, the third chapter of More on More.
So we've
originally
talked
titled More on More in the Moors.
More, yeah, more Mordor.
Moors of Scotland.
So,
Moors.
So we are talking about the legend of Alan Moore and the very myriad legends of Alan Moore and what makes the man a legend and why has so many things that he's done become legendary? Like what is the impetus for this? For the status that he has achieved, of this weird legendary, as Jefferson Harris calls it in the first, a shamanistic, you know, mystic, almost, you know, almost bearded man in the tower of comic books, and but also because we have Matt here tonight, I want to go back and sort of revisit some of the themes we've talked about and get his take on some things. I think it's important.
Absolutely.
Did we get as many different voices into this as we can, and
primarily so that we can geek out about Constantine, because
right,
as well, that's what one does, you know.
Well, we geek out totally, and for those who don't know, Andrew is also I cosplay John Constantine. Andrew is John Constantine.
Yes,
I do like the fact though that we don't cosplay Constantine in the same place at the same time. For the most part, I think that we just, you know, that's too much.
It would cause an antimatter explosion.
It's almost Fight Club. You know, you can't have Jack and Tyler Durden in the same scene at the same time. You can't have you cosplaying Constantine and me cosplaying Constantine in the same place at the same time. It would rip the fabric of space time if we did. We can't.
Also, I think what needs to happen is Starman needs to cosplay as Alan Moore. You cosplay as John Constantine, and that way you can cosplay as the legendary meeting.
Oh, that is such a good idea.
We can totally have that happen.
That is a brilliant idea.
Yeah, that is actually what needs to happen here, because
that is a fantastic idea. That is a great idea.
You heard it here first, folks.
When you see it, you know where the idea came from.
That's right.
But so in past episodes, we've talked about John. Now I'm thinking John. Now I got Constantine on the
Sorry.
Brain.
Sorry, my bad.
No, I'm ever not thinking about Constantine. We talked about Alan Moore's influence on comics, on writers, on artists, on the industry as a whole, and I want to get your feelings on that. What do you think he's done for the industry, Matt?
Well, you can't deny that he has had an effect on the industry. I mean, if you read any book on comic history or any article talking about the Dark Age onward, it will talk about, you know, Watchmen, obviously, that was a big influence on the industry as a whole. Basically kickstarted the Dark Age and the idea that we can have these stories that are, yes, they are about people in tights running around, but we can have, you know, foreshadowing, we can have themes, we can have, you know, subtext and symbology and all of these serious high literature ideals within the simple stories of men in tights punching other men in tights. But I think it's been his greatest influence has actually been a bit more personal than that. It hasn't just been the fact that, well, he wrote this one story and then everybody started ripping off that style or trying to rip off that style, because I think most would agree that the biggest problem with the Dark Age is that everybody looked at Watchmen, which had all these great elements of Gallivus acclaim, and they thought, yeah, well, all we need is more tits and violence.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
And they missed the whole point of what, you know, because we here at Hey Kids Comics, as you now know, and as if you didn't know before, kind of, you know, worship Watchmen as this this paragon, this apex comic, and I think that a lot of people,
especially if you're me,
writers, well, I do too. I mean, it's not I don't like Cole does, but I don't know if anybody like does it like Cole does.
Yeah.
You know, the point of Watchmen, from where I sit, isn't the dark and gritty realism of the book. It's the way that a story is told. And that's why I think, you know, when he goes out and says that this is unfilmable, I wanted to make something that was completely unfilmable. That's what he was getting at, was that, you know, this is a story that can only be told in comic form. It really is kind of the magnum opus of comics to that point. And I believe it has yet to be, I personally believe it has yet to be matched as far as competent storytelling goes. Now, I have my argument books for that. I certainly do. But do you think that your Grant Morrison's and your, you know, to a lesser extent for the purposes of narrative, for narrative's sake, Bendis's and guys like that have missed the point?
Morrison in particular, yeah. Now, don't get me wrong. Morrison has written some great comics, but I think he did kind of miss the whole point. And there is a whole argument about to what degree Morrison has tried to rip off Moore's shtick. as being, you know, the grand high shaman of the comics world. And
right.
Do not ask Alan Moore about Grant Morrison.
And that's one of the legends I wanted to get into was since we're here,
yes.
the legend of the vitriolic hatred that Alan Moore has for Grant Morrison. Because here's the thing, everybody's ripped off Alan Moore. You know, that's like saying that you ripped off Homer, you know, like
yeah.
As a comic book writer, everybody to a person in one way or another has borrowed from, you know, from the codex of Alan Moore. But Grant Morrison, granted, has in a big way done that. Do you think that it's for show, or do you think that Alan Moore really feels this way?
You know, he's a magician, so you can never really guess.
I mean, in the
stage magician sense, not the, you know, I'll cast fireball on you.
Careful.
Oh, well, that...
Careful who you're talking about.
I was getting excited there for a minute. I thought he was like a wizard.
Well, he might be.
We're going to get into that in the next issue.
Yeah. But
you know, the thing about it is, you know, just because he says something doesn't necessarily mean that it reflects his own opinion.
Right.
In many cases.
Yeah, I think he actually probably does not really care that much one way or the other, but he is sick of people asking him about it.
Right.
Because, Grant, I don't know if you've read Grant Morrison's History of Comics Super Gods.
I haven't yet, but I've wanted to. It's
well,
one of those that's on the...
He writes rather gushingly about Moore up until a point when... I will say this about Super Gods. It is a good history up to a point.
Okay.
It is when it starts getting to talking about the Bronze Age and the more modern influences that up until then it's a pretty good history about the whole idea of superheroes being modern mythology and Morrison's theories about that. And, you know, I've read other things he's written about the idea of the Justice League being, you know, the modern day Olympians and how you can draw parallels. You know, Superman is Zeus, Batman is Hades.
Which he did in his
Justice League run.
Right.
And, you know, it's a good concept. It works. And his Justice League is one of the best, in fact, it's one of the books that got me into reading comics in the first place back in college. But the point is that I do think that Morrison did kind of see a lot of what Moore was doing and has kind of tried to rip off the stardom element. I mean, Moore just kind of had the stardom element thrust upon him by virtue of being this great influential writer who was forging new territory. And Morrison, for lack of... It's like the whole saying that Isaac Newton had about where I've gotten, I got by standing on the shoulders of giants.
Right.
I think Morrison has started to see himself as one of the giants and not the, you know, forgotten where he was standing. Because
perhaps he was a giant standing on the shoulders of an even bigger giant.
A titan, yeah.
Oh, that's Zen, man. Wow.
I know.
Occasionally, but, I do draw from a deeper well than just, like, fart jokes.
Occasionally.
But the story about exactly why Moore has such a... And admittedly, Moore doesn't seem to have a lot of respect for the modern comics industry in general, but why he does have so much of a loathing for Grant Morrison is because he only met him once before, and he remembered it just being, you know, I'm the writer who's just starting to take off, and I've now got this fanboy flapping around me asking for ideas, like the little dog in that one Warner Bros. Cartoon. Oh, come on, Muggsy,
oh, yes.
Come to his house! Yeah, yeah, Muggsy's my hero!
Right.
And I can actually see, like, if the other the bigger dog had a big bushy beard.
Shut up.
That would be, yeah, it would be just like that.
Here's the thing about Alan Moore is I don't see him as actively, you know, looking down on people, because I feel like he sort of looks down on modern comics at this point.
Yeah, he doesn't go out of his way to insult particular people unless they've done something to annoy him personally.
And then you get the fire and the lightning, and yeah, but
he calls down the wrath of the beard.
Right, the Cyclopean beard, which is a game we're going to play later.
Nice. I enjoy that game.
Yeah, it's a game.
I got the home game.
Did you develop it yourself?
I did.
Nice.
For my home.
Literally the home game. Yeah. It's almost like, you know, the old adage is, you know, it's a...
Never meet your heroes?
It's a Lovecraftian analogy, but, you know, why are we to assume that Cthulhu even cares once he materializes? Because, you know, he sees us the way we see ants. And I have this feeling that Alan Moore sees the rest of the comic industry the way that we see ants, in the sense that it just doesn't... He's so far removed now that it does... In his own mind, I'm not saying that it's right or wrong, that it doesn't... That when the wasp stings him, he just, you know, swats at it. That's, you know, until something really bothers him, like Matt was saying, then he strikes out. But otherwise, he just kind of strides mightily across the landscape. And
now I'm thinking about this one story that he wrote for the old Vega book.
Okay.
It's in the DC collected, you know, works of Alan Moore.
Which has come up many times. Yes. Many times, yes.
But the gist of this basic story is that we have these two giants, and we have these tiny little
creatures. Oh, I know the story well.
Yeah, the tiny little creatures who are, you know, trying to attack these giants who are clearly here to destroy us, and they aren't, you know, the giants are just ignoring them completely. They're just there. And then we just cut the perspective of the giants and, huh, did you feel that?
Right.
It's like whole generations of these tiny little things have been trying to kill them for thousands of years from their perspective, and then it's just like seconds in the perspective of a giant, just, huh.
And, you know, that it's funny you mention that one, because in the context of what we've been talking about, is that not potentially what Moore.
Yeah.
You know, is that Moore writing on Moore?
Well, let's talk about that
without
legend.
Not necessarily realizing it.
Right.
You know, I think a lot of times.
Could also be metaphorical for you have the two big giants, you have Marvel and DC.
Ooh.
And then you have all of the tiny things trying to get their attention. It's like,
holy cow.
It could very well have been an analog. That's a good point. Also, the the big comic, the indie boom. And, you know, what do first comics and, you know, Defiant and all these others mean?
Valiant and,
in the long run, yeah. Was it like a...
Mirage and...
Yeah,
oh, Mirage.
Kitchen Sink Press and...
just keep bouncing those off comics. Of them, right, trying to take them down, and it's just, they feel nothing. It's, and that's, you know, that's another thing about Alan Moore that, it has actually come up on in this story arc, is, you know, how metaphorical is his work, because there are these legends that, oh, well, he wrote this story about this, or that story about that, and, you know, is it a personal reference, is it a reference against the industry, is it a reference, you know, is it a reference for society as a whole,
or...
and
is he just being the magician, and this is like sleight of brain?
Exactly.
And he
is... that's what I meant by comparing him to a magician earlier.
Yeah. And exactly. I wanted to invoke that again because
that
is a very good way to look at Moore. Because I think a lot of times some of the best artistic and creative minds are the ones who have the benefit of having their work analyzed while they're still alive and keep their mouth shut. Same way that the dead, you know, I remember sitting in art history classes and seeing people, you know, art historian types waxing about, you know, reading so much subtext into things. Maybe it's just possibly wanted to draw Jesus or something, you know, because everybody was doing it, or this particular, you know, the image of the hardworking, like the famous painting, the gleaners, you know, the people who are out there just trying to eke out what they can off the leavings of the harvest.
Right.
Touched him. Does this necessarily have to be a metaphor? I mean, my argument there is, and, you know, in this case, we're doing exactly what I hated in that, and that's just, you know, drawing our own conclusions. But unless the artist wrote something that said, you know, when I set about to make this painting, I wanted to take this real-life event and make it an analog to the struggles we all have as mortals. Unless they said that themselves, it's conjectural bullshit.
Well,
but at the same time, this we've done, 130-some-odd episodes of what is effectively conjectural bullshit.
Right, right.
So,
but then that's the thing.
I find myself...
Are we divining from the universe, or are we just jerking off?
Much like Constantine, if you will,
yes.
You know, regardless of how much pure magic Alan Moore has, the part of being this magician that we all feel that he is that it's at least 51% hucksterism. You know, it's at least 51% show. So you've got to ask yourself, these legends that we're talking about, the things we're going to talk about when it comes down to, you know, him saying he's going to piss fire all over Watchmen. Or, you know, V for Vendetta should never have been made. Or, you know, or Grant Morrison, I don't know who that guy is. Why is he quoting me? Or I met Constantine.
Yeah.
How much of that is pure showmanship to drive the legend? And I don't even think it's about money. I think it's to drive the legend of Alan Moore. You know,
and then at the same time, how much is a conscious decision to drive the legend, and how much of it is just the sort of happenstance? You know, I think a lot of things happen without necessarily having a conscious effort put forth.
Sure, sure.
And with Moore, it's impossible to really know which, or if it's a combination of many of these things, where, like, you know, happenstance created one part of the legend and he just took it and ran with it.
Or how much?
Like, you know, if you're going to look at me as legendary, I'll give you legendary.
Right. How much of it is the legend? You know, hitting the perpetual motion machine of Alan Moore's legendary status. How much of it is critical mass? How much of it is Alan Moore says something to, you know, the Daily Star, or, you know, the Globe, or and it just gets blown wholly out of proportion, and it just it snowballs into this legend.
Oh, absolutely. And then, and once that happens, you know, how much of it is just letting the legend feed on itself? Because, you know, once the legend's established, you can just let it, it becomes free range if you let it.
Right, right. And I think he lets it.
And if you want to, you can just sort of ride the wave.
But I think the only artist, and Starman might have to back me up on this because he's going to know better than I am, the only author that has really gotten the Alan Moore seal of approval has been Neil Gaiman.
Yes, well, I think there's a few other writers who he's had kind words about here and there, but I actually was going to talk about Neil Gaiman for a bit.
Yeah, please.
I believe his last name is actually pronounced Gaiman.
Is it? Okay.
Well, funny story about that. When he got an award from, Flag. He won an award for one of the death books for Flag, and he said that it was just so amusing that people were just cheering his last name, Gaiman.
That's hilarious.
I usually pronounce it Gaiman, so I have to like combine all possible pronunciations.
I pronounce it Gotcha Man. I know it's wrong, but I can't help it.
And before I heard this story, I always did the Jerry Lewis as Gaiman.
Nice.
Gaiman.
The nice lady and the
with the hair and the thing and the Gaiman.
And the Maven Flavin.
But this was actually, it goes back to what I was saying about how I think that Moore's ultimate influence on the industry may be more about how he directly influenced certain writers,
okay,
rather than, you know, his stories themselves. Uh-huh. Because a little known fact is that Alan Moore actually was the one who taught Neil Gaiman about how to write a comic script.
Really?
It's mentioned in the introduction to one of the Sandman graphic novels. Just I believe it's Dream Country, the third one, because that one does come with the Neil's original script for the story. I'm totally blanking on the title, but it's the one about the man who kidnaps a muse and begins raping her to get inspiration.
Okay, which sounds very, very much like it would be inspired by
that's,
Alan Moore.
That's Moore-ish, yeah.
Well, the story itself probably wasn't inspired by Alan, but in his introduction to showing the script, Neil explains he included this script because he was always having young writers ask him about, you know, a comic, you know, can I see one of your scripts to see how you do it? And he just says, you know, this is it. explains, Alan Moore showed me, you know, he taught me how to do this, and lots of different writers have their own ways, but this is the way I do it. If you want to start with this as a template, feel free, you know, find your own path. So, Sandman, we actually have a lot we actually have quite a bit to thank Alan Moore for having set Neil Gaiman on the path for that. But the other thing is another little interesting, and this ties back into Constantine. Alan Moore actually suggested when they were talking after his run on Swamp Thing, where John Constantine is created, there was talk at Vertigo, well, actually not Vertigo yet, but DC, about giving John his own book, and they asked Alan if he would write, and he said, well, I would, but he was knee-deep in writing several other things at that point. So he wound up recommending, I believe he actually did recommend Neil for the job, but the other, I can't remember if Jamie Delano got nominated first or if Neil made a proposal second, but Neil Gaiman put himself up for the job and eventually got turned down in favor of Jamie Delano.
Yeah.
So we could have actually had Neil writing, being the one to adapt Constantine, the very first, you know, post-Moore stories.
That would have been that would have been amazing. That would have been an amazing thing.
It's funny, though, because Neil has gotten to write John a fair bit. One of the first chapters of Sandman has John in it, and a lot of people think it's one of the better John stories. He did guest write one issue of Hellblazer, issue 27, which, again, is considered one of the better one-shot. It's the one which, and funny story about that, and, you know, gauging into Gaiman territory here.
Please.
The whole plot of issue 27 is it just shows these homeless people who freeze to death in the middle of a particularly, you know, harsh British winter night, and then just cuts to John, who is at a party, talking to some girl. She tries taking him back to his place, and she's trying to get him drunk, and John immediately figures out that something is going on, and then he immediately realizes, wait a minute, you said your name was Mac. you're the lesbian Meg. and it turns out that, yeah, it turns out, yeah, she's a lesbian, but she was trying to get John drunk because, well, she and her partner wanted to have a baby, and, well, they thought he was cute.
Wow.
They
have a baby, like, Mist from Sandman style. Just,
right.
Like, you know, drug somebody and
John is quite
physically steal their seat.
And John is quite rightfully outraged that, you know, they were trying to take advantage of him. Just as, you could have asked me.
You could have just asked. I would have...
Aww. And then he winds up going out into the, you know, and basically the homeless person that we saw before has now become basically this cold zombie, like a white walker, who is just walking around begging people to, you know, hold me. You know, he just wants a hug, and everybody who refuses, he just grabs him and drains the heat out of him, and John sees this, figures out what's going on, hugs the guy, he just fades away, you know, got his last wish, and then John goes back to the apartment and just says, yeah, I need someone to hold me right now. Well, aww. The funny thing about the story, I mean, it's a good story, it's very John. Apparently, Neil based this on something that really happened to him, about some lesbian friend of a friend trying to get him drunk.
Ah, okay.
So, you know, it's weird little... And the funny thing is that there's a very good book. It's all these interviews with Neil Gaiman about... it's like Neil Gaiman, the Dream King. It's just like an annotated Sandman book where they talk about every Sandman issue, and he talks about the stories that inspired it, the things that happened in real life, and he said, the funny part is a lot of the stories in Sandman were inspired by things that happened to me, and when I tell people this, they're like, oh, that would never happen. like the lesbian trying to take advantage of him because she wants a baby, or one of the later Sandman stories where Neil apparently got approached by a 16-year-old, you know, girl who was a lesbian who, you know, somehow got pregnant, and, you know, she never went through sex ed, so she has no idea how it happens. Like, well, I jumped up and down afterward and said, that doesn't work. and people just took him to task for that story because they thought, well, there's no way that a 16-year-old who identifies as a lesbian could ever possibly be that naive. And it's like, well... But getting back to Alan Moore and another Neil Gaiman story and how Moore is responsible for inspiring Neil, are you familiar with a story called Neverwhere?
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, it started out as a miniseries for BBC. They adapted into they adapted into a radio play, a comic book adaptation.
The book is phenomenal. The novel is phenomenal. Yeah.
The TV series is great. Well, what wound up inspiring the whole concept for Neverwhere was that Neil Gaiman and Alan Moore and some other friends were out at dinner, and Alan was in the middle of describing his latest story, which, it being an Alan Moore story, it was rather gory and violent. He was describing this magic ritual that he had made up that involved ritual human sacrifice, and this was an Italian place. So... And Alan is getting into great, vivid detail about this, and everybody else is all, you know, oh, that's amazing. Neil, who apparently is not the most
hardy
of people when it comes to trying to eat Italian food when people are talking about corpses being cut up, he just politely asks to be excused for a moment and just goes out, you know, sits on the curb, head between knees, and this woman just walks past and sees Neil. And if you've never seen a picture of Neil Gaiman, he doesn't comb his hair very often. He's frequently unshaven, tends to wear the same black outfit a lot of the time. So he's just sitting there on the curb, you know, head between his knees, just, you know, looking forlorn and messed up. And this woman just comes by and, you know, drops some change by him and just says, you know, there, it'll be fine. And he just feels like, oh, bloody hell, she thinks I'm homeless. And it just occurred to him how all it took was putting him in this one place, this one situation, looking messed up, and suddenly, I'm a homeless person.
Right, right.
And the whole plot of Neverwhere is about this guy who suddenly becomes a homeless person and winds up in the mystic realm that, you know, only the homeless people know exists beneath every major city in the world.
Yeah, realm of magic and weird and...
The underworld of London.
Right, which is a brilliant book. And that's the kind of stuff I want to get into because, you know, that's the legend of Alan Moore, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, it's not even the fact that, you know, which we're going to get into right this second, that he met Constantine, or allegedly met Constantine.
Yeah,
twice.
It's that he has this effect on people. He has this kind of, weird
secondhand brilliance.
Yeah, magic touch that when he's around people, he's almost his own. He's almost a muse in disguise. Where just being in his presence will spark that. Yes, let's talk about, I know it's Matt and I's favorite, Alan Moore legend. I'm pretty sure it's Cole's as well, cause I've made it his.
Yeah. I've sort of adopted it, to make it mine.
Is the fact that on two separate occasions, Alan Moore says, and has said, frequently when asked, that he has met John Constantine. Not somebody who looks like John Constantine, not somebody who says that, not Matarai in costume. He has met the John Constantine. There was one where he I think he met him on a bench. Is that right, Matt?
I believe it was coming out of a bar, actually.
Okay, no shock there. And there was another where Constantine apparently taught him magic. Is that, am I far off on that?
Yeah, the way I understand the first one, that it was, it was either a restaurant or a bar, might have been a pub, and that he was just, sitting there, and then suddenly John Constantine comes down the stairs from, like, the upper level, and says, he looks at me, I look at him, smiles, nods, walks around the corner, and Alan Moore just saw this and thought, well, do I go around the corner or not, and then decided, no.
And keep in mind, this was not prior to the creation of John Constantine.
Yeah,
this guy is my influence for this character. This is after the character had been created.
Yeah, this was late 80s sometime.
Right, he had the hair, he had the trench coat, he had the tie, he had the shirt, he had the pants, he had the bandages. He says that it was John Constantine. There's no doubt in his mind that who he saw was John Constantine.
And then the second time... I don't remember the location, but apparently that was the second time, and this time they actually did speak. But he didn't so much teach Moore how to do magic, he just told him, I'll tell you the secret of ultimate magic. Any expletive can do it.
Really?
Yeah, the exact phrasing was actually, I'll tell you the ultimate secret of magic. Any bleep can do it.
Okay.
And I know that we're not
strictly
opposed.
If we only knew it was so simple.
Right.
I know we're not strictly opposed to cursing on this, but this is a rather bad bleep.
Understood. So what do you make of this, the both of you? Like, is it... I'm almost to the point where, because I'm, as you know from our Cryptids episode and various other podcast appearances I've done, I'm open to the belief of extra worldly things. I'm almost to the point now where I want to believe that this is true. Like, I want to believe that somehow, in some way, just the sheer force of Alan Moore as Will and the fan base, surrounding that has willed Constantine
and
into
and just sheer quantum mechanics. Anything is possible in an infinite universe.
Right. That whole Joseph Campbell, if you create a world and populate it, it exists idea. And if not, how brilliantly crazy is it that the man has come out publicly and said that he met his creation?
Well, it's not just Moore, and you can talk about this being, the other creators are buying into the myth and trying to encourage it, but... Alan Moore isn't the only creator who says that they have seen or met John Constantine.
Really? Okay, I'm not aware of this. Okay, here we go.
Yeah. I actually did talk about this, talking about Alcon. This past Alcon, I actually did a panel upon the history of John Constantine as a character. And I did talk a little bit about this, but Jamie Delano, who was the first person who wrote Hellblazer after Swamp Thing, he said that he saw John Constantine at the British Museum. He did not follow after him. Brian Azzarello, who is currently writing, Wonder Woman, or was writing Wonder Woman for DC recently, and also wrote Hellblazer, he says that he saw, well, this one's a little more believable, he saw John Constantine at a bar while he was there drinking, so that might have influenced it a little bit, but he saw John at a bar in Chicago at one point. But the weird thing is, while I've heard this story most about John, people claiming to have met comic book characters in real life or writers saying that they've met them, it's not that unusual.
Yeah.
Julius Schwartz, who was the editor-in-chief of DC Comics forever, claims that he met Clark Kent in the back of a cab once.
Really?
The thing about it is, he very well could have met a Clark Kent.
Right.
And the thing is, it could be one of those things that gets taken out of context, and depending on how shrewd you are and what kind of effect you want to get out of it, you could just run with it. Because, you know, for example, who was it? I was actually going somewhere with this at one point.
It's okay. It's been a long week for everybody.
Yes. Good night. But you know, essentially, you know, if you, it's like this thing where we're listening to Patrick Stewart being interviewed about something that was going around the internet, that this picture of him having a piece of pizza, and the thing got misconstrued into this was the first piece of pizza he'd ever had in his life, and it was the man's.
Oh, I heard that.
And it's like, no, it was like, and it was beautiful to hear him tell it, because, you know, you could, to hear him tell anything, he could read the ingredients off the Lucky Charms box, and it would be a beautiful thing. But he was talking about how, you know, like, no, of course, you know, when I was pizza all the time, I was growing up, you know, he didn't have, it was back in those days, we didn't have kale or quinoa. Well, we had kale, but we fed it to the cattle. But he's talking about what it was this, he and his wife had been out drinking, and she rightly pointed out, you know, he'd had a lot to drink. What he needed was some grease. And she's like, well, why don't we go get a slice of pizza? He's like, well, why can't we just get a pizza? She's like, no, you just need a slice. And so it was like the first time he'd ever gone anywhere and, like,
bought the slice.
Yeah. And, you know, there was like a little picture that went out on the internet, and it got misconstrued as the first pizza he'd ever had. And I think it was one of those sorts of things where it's like, oh, yeah, I met this guy who's got the same name as my creation, John Constantine. Not like for real. And somebody's like, he met John Constantine. And, you know, if you're Alan Moore, why not say, yes, I did. That's exactly what I said. You know, if you're Patrick Stewart, you deny that that's your first piece of pizza ever, because it's true. If you're Alan Moore, why not admit to something you didn't say, even if it isn't true?
Well, it's like my favorite cosplay story. What 2 years ago at AllCon, when I'm dressed up in my normal attire, and people keep telling me that my Sherlock costume is great, and about the first three times you say no, this is the way I dress, and by the fourth time you say, a thank you. That's, yeah, that, you know,
like, you're just like, I loves me some Johnny Lee Miller.
That's right. That's what you end up doing. But could it be the other option, which is Alan Moore operates at a frequency so different than we do that he believes that this is what happened? You know,
it could be that, you know, in whatever combination of, you know, the way he is naturally, without any chemical influence, under the influence of some or a lot of chemical stimulants, or just, you know, him being generally weird, it's just a good idea. You know, at some point, he's pretty convinced that this happened, whether it did or not,
right,
in reality.
Right.
Maybe this is just a callback to this, but the official explanation of the whole multiple Earths thing back in the pre-crisis days. Yeah, there have been a bunch of crises now, so you have to have the pre-crisis and the pre-crisis.
Right, exactly.
You know, the original Silver Age days, back when it was still, you know, Barry Allen and Jay Garrick, and we had Earth 1 and Earth 2.
Right.
Well, when they introduced Barry Allen into the comics, you know, their whole explanation for how he came up with the name of the Flash was that he had read, you know, the Flash comics with Jay Garrick when he was growing up.
Exactly.
And he took that as a name.
And
then when they did the Flash of Two Worlds story, where they had them team up, they came up with this whole theory about, well, you know, there's a different vibrational frequency for each Earth, and how maybe the people who wrote the comics were in tune with it, and their dreams let them see your adventures, and then they wrote them down.
So in other words, this whole thing that's going on in DC right now is about Alan Moore seeing John Constantine. the entirety of what is it? The concordance, the
convergence,
the convergence. The entire convergence is about Alan Moore writing John Constantine, and that being the book that unlocks all the worlds. Is that
well? And then, and not at all ironically, especially in this context, is you have this almost as Andy and I a couple of days ago were discussing a kind of Red King syndrome. So it's not at all surprising that that was the title of one of the story arcs from Miracle Man.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, where there is conjecture as to whether or not, you know, all of existence isn't just one individual's dream. And in the case of the Red King, everyone was terrified to wake him for fear of being called out of existence because all of his subjects felt that they were the product of his dream.
Right.
Well, getting back into the potential supernatural explanations of it, I mentioned before how Julius Schwartz claimed to have met Clark Kent, you know, and you know it was actually Superman in disguise in a cab. I tried searching the internet, thinking about this because I thought I might bring this up, but I can't find the original story now. Apparently, there's some story somewhere that somebody wound up making contact with this remote tribe. You know, had never made contact with the outside world. And how they had this legend amongst their people about how this volcano was about to destroy, you know, their land, but how this flying man with a odd blue, you know, odd blue garment and this other red robe flew out of nowhere and, you know, capped the volcano and, you know, stopped the lava flow, and how somebody was going, wait a minute, that sounds like Superman. So, and you can start talking about this, and there's a whole theory. I forget the official term for it, but it's basically the gist of the World of Darkness role-playing game in regards to the magicians and the fairy.
Right.
That basically, technology is making people more, you know, married to this is how this works, this is how things are meant to be, and imagination is dying, and we're losing access to the concept that anything is possible, and how there are certain places, you know, still untouched by civilization, where that imagination can break through, and you could, for instance, have a superhero punch through reality to help people, but only show up in this remote place where nobody would be able to film it or, you know, do anything like that. And you want to get really fancy and remote on the geek references, which, of course, I do.
Yeah, please.
Well, again, this kind of ties in the same idea. And you can talk about being like a symbiotic thing. It can be like the whole, to mention Neil Gaiman's story, The Dream of a Thousand Cats, where if you get a lot of people believing and focusing on something, that belief can move a mountain. You know, the 100 Monkeys theory.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not quite the whole, well, if we all believe John Constantine is real and clap our hands, then John Constantine will be real and Tinkerbell will live. But there is this episode of The Real Ghostbusters.
Because it takes John Constantine to save her.
That's right.
Clap, you bloody white ghost, clap! I'm just picturing that.
That was way too excitement than he would have. He would definitely
clap,
not.
Clap, you bloody white, yeah, it yeah. Willy Wonka, help, police, murder.
Right!
Nice.
But there was this episode of The Real Ghostbusters cartoon where they wound up teaming up with the ghost of Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. And it was pointed out, well, wait, Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson were never real people. There aren't really ghosts. And, well, it's throughout this theory that, well, a lot of people believe in them. I mean, a lot of people believe Sherlock Holmes was a real person and that Dr. Watson was a real person. And, in fact, I forget which bank it is. It's the bank where they actually have on Baker Street where, you know, the actual address from the books is. There's actually a gentleman at the bank who his official title is Secretary to Mr. Holmes. His job is to answer all of the fan mail that gets sent to the bank in care of Sherlock Holmes.
Really? That's pretty awesome.
Wow, nice.
That's on my list of dream jobs right there.
Right?
Yeah.
But yeah, people actually do write to Sherlock Holmes as if he was a real person, so it's not totally unheard of, even outside of the comic book genre, that, you know, that belief is there and that people will claim that they saw some fictional character or something like that.
Well, right on. There's one other, it's not a legend, but it's legendary that that on Alan Moore's wedding, and this, I think this speaks to his curmudgeonly level of friendship with people that I think he holds with very few. You know, I think that's part of the legend of Alan Moore, is that he is just this eternally morose, grumpy guy. Like almost pedantically British, you know what I mean? Like that's his demeanor, is that, and I've heard him, I've heard Neil Gaiman, talk about, you know, their conversations and the way that they go. But my favorite one, and Cole and I have talked about this before, was that he had he never stopped arguing with Dave Gibbons about Watchmen, ever. And my favorite one of those, like, any time that the scripts would go through, and they were friends, they were good friends, they were writing partners, and the only, and I think the most contentious for Dave was that at Alan Moore's wedding, like, as Alan Moore was leaving the church in which he was wedded, he stopped where they take pictures and leaned over and made a disparaging comment to Dave about Watchmen, like, as he was coming out. And neither Dave nor Alan spoke on this until Alan's newly minted wife did. which you know, is another one of those things about Alan Moore that he's, you know, it's hard to pin him down. It's hard to pin him down because he is a mentor, but he's the reluctant mentor to some people. You know, he is an influence, but he is a guarded influence. He is a mystic, but he's also
the trickster mentor.
Right, he's a mystic, but he's a mystic in hiding. He's very vocal about his work, but he also doesn't want people talking about his work. You know,
he's starting a war for peace.
Exactly. you know, what do we say as we wrap this show up about that, about Alan Moore as a legendary figure? How long will this... Is this going to be something that we keep discovering and keep talking about for as long as we talk about comics? I mean, because we still do it with guys like Stranko, and we still do it with guys like Kirby.
Is this like what we talk about when we talk about comics?
Right. Is this... Wow. Really?
Oh, first Birdman reference.
Wow.
Damn it.
I'm bad. I still haven't seen it.
Oh, you would like it. You would like it.
Yeah, I'm sure I would. It's just a matter of when have I had the time lately.
Right. But, I mean, is that something...
I haven't seen Avengers yet, so there you have it.
Is this something that we're going to be continually... and not just his influence, but his legend. You know, like, Alan Moore considers Jack Kirby a mentor. Yeah, that's, you know, a lot of Alan Moore's early work, and even into his later work with character development, he cites Jack Kirby as a major mentor for the weirding of his work, you know, for the outlandish nature, for the insanity. He cites Jack Kirby because that's what Jack Kirby did. Nobody was doing what Jack Kirby started doing. Mm-hmm. Nobody was doing Fourth World, and nobody was doing New Gods, and nobody was doing the Kirby Crackle and people in cocoons and
whatever, Kirby Cocoon, yeah.
Yeah, whatever weird stuff he was doing. You know, we look now at guys like Matt Fraction. And guys like who's the guy that wrote that's drawing Howard the Duck now? Chip Zdarsky.
Zdarsky, yes.
Yeah, you look at the art and the stuff. Obviously, in my mind, they're highly influenced by Alan Moore's work for character development and story structure and art. You know, and what you view as an Alan Moore storytelling art structure, because he was highly involved in that in most of his books. You know, are we going to be continuing to talk about Alan Moore for the rest of our natural lives?
I think so, if nothing else, because, going into a quick story about a more direct influence that he's had.
Absolutely.
And how, okay, well, and this is something that Moore has complained about, of course, in regards to DC Comics. He has gone record saying that DC Comics... most of what is happening at DC Comics right now would not be possible without him. And that may sound egotistical, but it's true, because just to name the one thing that drove most of DC Comics up until the New 52 for the past 10 years, or 10 years ago for 5 years, all of the main DC universe is being driven by one Alan Moore story. Tigers. It was a Green Lantern Corps anthology story that was written just to answer one big simple question, one that nobody had ever considered in regard to the Green Lantern mythos, except it's a smart aleck joke. Why is Abin Sur flying a spaceship when the Green Lantern ring lets you fly from space? Right. So Alan Moore wrote this whole story about how, about how Abin Sur had been given a prophecy that told him that his ring would fail him, which made him paranoid and made him start flying a ship around just to be safe. And, of course, because he was in a ship, he became vulnerable to this attack that the ring couldn't save him from, which led to him crashing on Earth, which led to Hal Jordan becoming Green Lantern. Well, that story wound up becoming the impetus for most of the Green Lantern stories by Jeff Johns.
Yes, yes, they
leading
did.
Leading up through the Color War, the Sinestro Corps War,
Black,
the War of Light, Blackest Night. Yep.
Absolutely.
And all of that came about because of this prophecy, and then him saying, well, it turned out there was a different prophecy, and how Sinestro was helping him investigate this, and how Sinestro was given a prophecy about how chaos would befall his world, which he didn't take seriously until he realized that what Abin had heard had come true. So Sinestro's whole downfall was caused by this same prophecy. So Sinestro suddenly goes from being, you know, generic evil Vincent Price bad guy with the mustache and the obvious bad guy name to being an anti-hero.
Right.
I love the story. I think it was brilliant what they did with him and how they turned Sinestro into a sympathetic character to a point. And how, you know, he ultimately was just one more tool who, you know, got jacked around by a prophecy because the Guardians couldn't be bothered to say, we're not going to have this happen.
Right.
But one of my favorite Alan Moore stories, just because Moore has gotten such a reputation in recent years for being oh so negative about anybody adapting anything off of his work, and to be fair, given some of the adaptations, you can't blame him for being a little upset about it. But it's a story about before all that happened, because this is something a lot of people don't realize was adapted from an Alan Moore story, the movie From Hell.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that's one of his.
Yeah, they don't even know that there was a book, much less that Alan Moore wrote it.
Yeah, it's like the people who go to, like, to Half Price or something, like, find Road to Perdition or A History of Violence.
Yep, yep.
Yeah. Well, when everybody talks about, he's always had this conventionally old man, I remember an interview that he gave right after From Hell was getting ready to come out, and they were asking him about the book and the movie and, you know, how he felt about it. And he goes, well, you know, I don't really care. I don't really plan on seeing it. It's not something, if they want to do it, I'll take the check. I'll donate to charity. You know, it's something, it's a medium. Film is not something that's ever interested me. But what I loved is the last little bit when they asked, so you're not going to the premiere? He said, no, I am going to go to the premiere. I'm not sure if I'm going to sit through the movie yet, but I am going to premiere for two reasons.
Oh, no.
Yeah. The first one is, my teenage daughter will kill me in my sleep if I deny her the chance to meet Johnny Depp. And then I said, what's the other reason? If I am going to allow my teenage daughter to meet Johnny Depp, I need to be there to act as a responsible adult supervisor and, if necessary, drive the getaway van when she shows up with him in duct tape. So I hear that story. And, you know, it's funny. A lot of people don't think about Alan Moore being a funny guy or, you know, his stories being humorous.
Pithy,
because
he does write
some very dark, very twisted stuff.
Humor.
Yeah.
He doesn't do it very often, and that's not the public face you normally get. But like the stuff he did for Time Twisters is rife with a lot of humorous bits.
Well, a lot of what he does is really funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, people don't think about that being a comedic piece, but there's so much dark, twisted humor in that. And I'm not talking about, Mr. Hyde raping the Invisible Man. Ironic comedy.
We'll talk about that on the last episode.
Yes, that reputation. But more just the little gags like the third chapter of the first League of Extraordinary Gentlemen book. It's Alan Moore's tribute to Victorian-era pornography.
Yes.
And the artwork is full of all these little in-jokes. The story is full of these little in-jokes and puns, and you have to be a Shakespeare geek who knows the double meaning of nothing to get half of them, but...
Also, one of the things that was another of those examples of that synergy between writer and artist, where there was so many little things going on in the background, and like when they go to the girls' school where they first encounter...
That's the chapter I was...
Yeah, because the design of the girls' school looking like this bare ass with a giant hand...
Hand getting ready to spank it, yes.
Yeah, it was just blatantly obvious, yet somehow perfectly
and the girl who is so cheerful about having been savaged by the invisible, by the spirit seven times is named Pollyanna.
Yeah, exactly. How she got exported to Europe, we don't know, but who cares?
Right. Well, I think that for me, you know, the thing about Alan Moore that I the funniest thing in my mind, and you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong about the writer, but I don't think I am, because I think it was in the same anthology. The bounty hunter went to find the greatest of the Green Lanterns.
That's
in that same anthology when he goes to find the greatest of the Green Lanterns and he's going to hunt him down. Exactly, and the line, because the greatest of the Green Lanterns was was Mogo, and so he goes to find Mogo and take Mogo on, and he doesn't know that Mogo's the planet. The planet-based Green Lantern, and the brilliant line that he wrote, which is "Mogo doesn't socialize," stands for me to be one of the funniest and most quotable lines of any comic book.
Absolutely. They actually adapted that beautifully for animation.
Yeah, they did.
In the Green Lantern, not First Flight.
The Tales of the Green Lantern Corps.
Yeah, it was an anthology of different Green Lantern stories, and they animated that one beautifully, captured the spirit perfectly, and you have Nathan Fillion narrating it as Hal Jordan, which is, you know, perfect voice acting choice. But the bounty hunter in question, Balfaga the Unrelenting, is voiced by Rowdy Roddy Piper.
Ah, nice.
With his little megaphone shouting, "Mogo, I shall destroy you and eat your blood."
But it never occurred to me until just now that the way that it was depicted in that animated was much like we're doing now, because it's as much a legend about Mogo, which is what they were telling.
A good point, yeah.
They were all sitting around the table telling this story. He was telling the recruits about Mogo. And I believe, if I'm not wrong, and Matt, you'll have to correct me on that, I think I'm basically right about that. But it's as much a legend about Alan Moore as it is about Mogo, you know. And I think that that's what happens so often now, is that when comic conversations turn to Alan Moore, it stops being a conversation about comic books and becomes a conversation about the legend of Alan Moore. And I wouldn't have it any other way, because I absolutely love I love the one-upsmanship that comes from those conversations. Like for instance, before Cole joined us tonight, we were having a conversation about Alan Moore's beard, which is legendary in its own right.
Oh, and especially in this arc and the
in its own scope,
creator's spotlight that preceded it.
So I would like to pose this question as we bring this show to a close. What is the best adjective that you can think of for Alan Moore's beard? The legendary beard of Alan Moore. Because Matt started it off with, and I forget the sentence that you used, Matt, for the beard.
You said something about it being a transient beard.
I did say it was a transient beard, I did.
And I just said, don't you mean sentient?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, the sentient beard of Alan Moore. So I would like to open that up.
That's going
to
be a new anthology series coming out from Avatar Press. The sentient beard of Alan Moore. It's like, you know, Dark Horse does The Savage Sword of Robert E. Howard. We're now going to have the sentient beard of Alan Moore.
So what is the best the best adjective you can give me for Alan?
I'm really trying to force
Because I would like to go with Cyclopean Beard of Alan Moore, because it is giant, sentient, and unwieldy in the Lovecraftian sense.
I'd probably go with Voluminous.
Nice! Nice! Yeah. Cole, do you have anything?
I like Voluminous a lot, by the way.
I do, too.
I would say, in a way, it's... I would dare say to maybe perhaps coin a definition, the helical, in that it literally feeds back on itself.
Wow.
It becomes like the snake feeding on itself.
Mobius-esque beard of Alan Moore. That's great.
And I would all further just say that it is mythological.
I think that it is mythological. I think we could continue to have this.
We shall call it the Ouroboros beard. that makes it sound like a Dan Brown novel, the Ouroboros beard.
The Ouroboros beard.
I read that, actually. It's really
good. it's the Tom Clancy.
Tom Clancy's Ouroboros beard.
Ouroboros beard codex. So I think that we could have this conversation yearly, and it would be a fresh conversation. Thank you so much, Matt, for joining us tonight. Couldn't have thought of a better person to do this issue of Hey Kids Comics with us. You've been
because the legend was something that we very much wanted to explore.
Right.
And we needed someone who could speak to this in a way that did it justice, basically.
And you definitely brought
justice.
You did
justice with a side of spaghetti.
Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure being on here. I'll come back again, you know, whenever.
Come back again in 63 episodes.
Right. But please,
or
Matt.
Whatever it has been.
Please, Matt, plug all of your things so people know where to find you and your awesome work.
Yes.
All right. Well, there is quite a bit of it. I'm busy boy right now. Probably the easiest way to find me is to check out my website, mygeekygeekyways.com. I'm on Twitter as just geekygeekyways. I'm on YouTube as Starman Morrison, where I've just started doing my very first Let's Play of the Discworld adventure game.
Okay.
Which kind of connects back to this in a roundabout way of I started doing it recently because Terry Pratchett, one of my favorite fantasy writers, passed on recently. And he was kind of in that same clique of weird writers. He was also friends of Neil Gaiman. They co-wrote stuff a lot together as well. And what got me into reading this in the first place was I was an adventure gamer back in middle school. And I got into playing the Discworld game because, well, Eric Idle, Monty Python, did the voice of the main character. And I was at that. I was one of those teens who, anything Monty Python, I got to see it. And so it just had this weird little incestuous... This got me to this, and then got me reading the books, and then that led to all of this, and so it's kind of a journey home for me covering this game, but it's good fun, and I'm pleased with the results so far. So let's see, that's my YouTube account. I also write comic book reviews for Kaboom.com. That's Kaboom with five O's, no apologies. Kaboom! that's our motto. And I also, if you want to read something more serious and literary, I'm one of many librarians and teachers who writes comic book reviews for NoFlyingNoTights.com. It's a little more cerebral. It's aimed at parents and educators who want to know not just is this good, but you know how much bad content do I have to worry about?
Right.
If I buy this for my library, do I need to worry about a lynch mob?
Yeah. So, would you say, Leave Extraordinary Gentlemen is kid-friendly, mother-approved? Like,
oh, God, no.
Like kick cereal? Not gonna happen.
You know, I actually did review one of the Leave Extraordinary Gentlemen Century Part 2 for No Flying, No Tights. And I forget exactly what I said about it, but... Well, in order to score a complete set of the Sin City novels for my library, I agreed to write a review of each individual one. And usually when I do a review for them, I leave the parental guidance stuff at the very end. And I had great fun with the Sin City review at the end of just saying, at this point, if you need me to tell you that this is not suitable for children, you probably shouldn't be reading it.
Marv isn't like the Barney version of. Oh, we didn't even get into the Frank Miller Alan Moore debacle.
Well, such is the legend.
Right.
There's so much ground to cover, but you know, in answer to the question that we were leaving on, I think as long as people have access to Moore's work, as long as it's out there for people to find, we will always have the discussions of the genius and the influence and the legend of Alan Moore.
Absolutely. That is the best way I can think of to close the show. Cole, would you plug us up, please?
I will do that. You are listening to Hey Kids Comics through the auspices of none other than the Jedi Cole Universe at JediCole.com. You can write to us, and please, for the love of God, someone write to us at JCUmail@yahoo.com. And that is M-A-I-L. Maybe all of our mail is going to JCUmaile, and God knows who that is. You can get the occasional tweet on Twitter at the Jedi Cole U and the Jedi Cole Universe YouTube channel. Within about a month and a half, we'll start to have some serious, real new video content. Plus, the Jedi Cole Universe is hosting its first comic, toy, and collectible swap meet, which will actually be my seventh such event to produce. This will be the first time under the JCU. And that will be on Saturday, August 22nd, in Arlington, Texas. And you can find out about that and many another convention on Convention Awareness Project Texas at cap-tx.info.
There you go. We have a bunch of actually already cut, waiting to go up. They probably will be up by the time this show airs. Interviews from Free Comic Book Day 2015, ready to rip, ready to upload, ready to be seen. I'm working on one particular long video called Monk's. What's your favorite? It's going to be it's going to be a real long,
amazing show.
It's going to be a real long show presented by us. But I'm glad that everybody had a really good Free Comic Book Day. I realize this is going to be a couple weeks after that, but it does my heart good to see new readers and people that might not be into the literary scene that is comic books, you know, delving in and getting a chance to really peruse and dig deep and ask the questions and get involved. So that's awesome. All that being said, it's time to say goodnight. Say goodnight, folks.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, folks.
And we'll talk to you next week with the politics and mysticism of Alan Moore.